Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Our future is energy dependent. Our successful future, one that is sustainable, is dependent on new thinking about efficiency, integration, and new and renewable sources of energy. It's a lot to think about, and many people are thinking about it, but perhaps no one more than our guest this hour. Amory Lovins is an innovator and practitioner in energy with an understanding of how it links to security, development, the environment, and the economy. He has consulted heads of states and governments the world over and has been referred to as one of the Western world's most influential energy thinkers. The chief scientist and chairman emeritus of Rocky Mountain Institute. He's about to speak at Catawba College in Salisbury on April 17th at about 6:30 in the Keppel Auditorium. You can register for that ahead of time, and it's absolutely free. And Amory Lovins joins us now for the hour in advance of that. Welcome.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here. If you'd like to join our conversation, well, I can't do that today. We don't have an internet. I can't ask people to be part of this because I can't read it off the screen. Never mind. So before we share your thoughts about energy, let's talk about you for a moment because you are remarkable. You went to Harvard and Oxford. You dropped out of both, but you've taught at 10 universities. You've written 31 books, more than 600 professional papers. You've designed super efficient buildings, including the home you live in, which we'll talk about, factories, vehicles. In fact, you've taught or are teaching at Stanford's engineering school, but only on topics you've never studied, so that you can have a beginner's mind as you teach these topics. And you're a physicist, but that doesn't really tell your story. So how would you describe yourself and what you do and what you have done?
Well, recovering physicist. I try to put away assumptions and preconceptions because my old mentor, Edward Land, who invented instant photography, said that people who seem to have had a new idea have often just stopped having an old idea. That's the hard part. And when I have a design problem, the real hard part is getting the question right. If you get the question right, the answer becomes self-evident. So, for example, I'm talking to you from our house and indoor farm where we just harvested our 75th passive solar banana crop. This is a little unusual, though, because we're 7,100 feet up in the Rockies where it used to go as low as minus 47F on occasion. We even once saw 39 days of continuous midwinter cloud, and this building has no heating system. It's an early passive house, that is, enough heat comes in through the super windows and is released inside by the people, lights, appliances, and maybe a 50-watt dog, that you don't need a heating system. And it's cheaper to leave it out because you save more construction costs not putting in the heating system than you pay for the stuff that gets rid of the heating system, like super insulation. So we ended up saving 99% of the space and water heating energy, 90% of the electricity, half water. And there was a slight extra cost for some of those other savings, but we got our money back in 10 months. That's 1983 technology. Today's is a lot better. Wow. But to get that kind of result, you can't optimize the windows or the insulation just as components. You got to optimize the house as a system. And then ask, is there a way to design this thing so it doesn't need heat? Answer is yes. Now there's hundreds of thousands of them in Europe, and they're coming to the U.S.
Now, you just referenced, at the very beginning of your comments, you just referenced, I think his first name is Edward Land, is that right?
Edwin, yeah.
Edwin Land, and he is the inventor of the Polaroid camera, and you referenced him in reference to people being stuck in a paradigm of old thinking when they can't think of new ideas because they're stuck in how things are. Is it ironic to you that Polaroid died because it was stuck in the past and new technology eclipsed it?
It's there are certain irony there, but it was a complicated situation. It's more ironic, I suppose, is is Kodak, which cratered just as digital cameras came on the market. You know, the capital markets didn't even wait for the toast to get done. They said, this company's in the toaster. We're going to pull our money out and put it into the new stuff. And that's what's happening now in energy. Investors are getting skittish.
You were one of the early people who I think began to really take energy and our need for energy and our need to think differently about energy seriously. When did your interest in the energy field begin?
During the 60s, in college, I started to realize the world was headed for an almighty train wreck, and it was because of a tangle of issues that, Mike, you mentioned a little earlier, around resources, environment, economy, development, security. And it seemed to me energy was kind of a master key for unlocking a lot of those puzzles and for some other issues like water that are similar but not identical, at least giving us coaching what to do. So I decided to work on energy by 71, and my first professional paper on climate change was actually in 68, so 51 years ago. I then wanted to do a doctorate in energy, and Oxford said, energy? What's that? It's not an academic subject, is it? We haven't a chair in it. Pick a real subject. So I said, well, I'm sorry, but I think it's going to be really important pretty soon, and I need to go work on it, so I'll just resign the fellowship and go do it. So I did. And they now have 300-odd people working on it, and right. Chairs in it. I was just two decades too early.
You, speaking of energy, you were a member at one point, and maybe you still are, of the U.S. National Petroleum Council, but you also have founded the Rocky Mountain Institute's Hypercar Institute. Hypercars use very little gas. They're super efficient. How do these two things go together?
Well, Secretary of Energy appointed me as one of the outside the industry members, although I've worked in for the industry for 46 years now, to give him good advice, and then they could give him better advice. And I think the oil and gas industries have a remarkable set of skills, some of which will also be useful in the new world. And for a long time, I've had the opportunity to advise various oil industry leaders how to try to make that tough transition. And then we do the same thing with leaders of the electricity industry. That's the other big energy story that's transforming before our eyes. This is all the biggest change in technology since agriculture. It's a really big deal. And I think a lot of people don't realize quite how fast it's going because it's all around us. The fish doesn't know it's in the water.
Yeah, we're going to talk a lot about that as we go through because it seems on the one hand that things are status quo, they're changing slowly, that people are putting up roadblocks to what seems to be an inevitable change. And what you're going to talk about this hour is why it's going to be inevitable and how it's to the benefit of some of these. It's certainly to the benefit of society, but it's to the benefit of some of these companies to embrace this. You've said that fossil fuels now generally cost more than the modern renewable sources that have already taken over two-thirds of the world's power plant market. Petroleum producers know this. Are they prepared to be energy companies? You talk to these guys. Energy companies as opposed to oil and gasoline companies.
Well, and even beyond that, energy service companies. You know, Thomas Edison, when he invented the utility business in about 1880, he didn't sell electricity. He sold light. It would charge you a penny to run a lamp for an hour. The reason he did that was, as a great inventor, he knew that people would come up with much more efficient lamps than the one he'd developed the previous year. Mm-hmm. And when that happened, he wanted his cost to go down so his profit could go up. And if he was delivering a lighting service, sure enough, his cost of delivering that service would go down if the lamp needed less electricity. However, in 1892, he was overruled, and New York Edison Company stopped selling light and started selling electricity, so customers could use it for whatever they want. Trouble is, you don't actually want electricity. You want hot showers and cold beer or other energy services. And the more efficiently you learn to use electricity, the more the utility will lose not cost but revenue, mm-hmm. which is what they were trying to get. So their whole business model is upside down. And similarly, the oil and gas industry is selling us molecules rather than the comfort, mobility, and other services we want. So I think both those great industries are going to have to start providing services in order to sustain revenue as customers get more efficient.
Like what? Because we are becoming more efficient. And in fact, at least Duke Power here in Duke Energy in the Carolinas encourages people to be more efficient. They send out free LED light bulbs to customers, for crying out loud. These things used to cost $25. They're sending them out free. So they want you to be more efficient. So what are you talking about in terms of selling services as opposed to electricity or gasoline?
Well, for example, in metropolitan France, the main way people keep warm in their buildings, commercial buildings, in the winter, is to get a service called chauffage. It's a heating service you get from a chauffagiste. That's an entrepreneur who says, I will keep this much floor space in this temperature range during these hours at this price. How I do it is my business. So maybe they'll come in first and you have an old oil furnace, they'll tune up or replace the furnace, they'll buy cheaper oil, they'll maintain and operate it better. But they can also, for example, stop up the cracks around your windows, insulate your building, put in better windows, put in better equipment of other kinds. And anything that delivers the heating service or the comfort service you want cheaper, they can do. And that way, your interest and theirs are aligned. The more efficient they make the building, the more money you and they both make. Aligning.
But how does that work? If they're going to come in and supply you with the heat that you need, which we all want to be comfortable, but to do that at the price they agreed on, they have to come in and caulk your windows and insulate your walls and make sure your attic is not leaking air and that your doors are sealed. That costs money. How do they do it? Without charging you an arm and a leg?
Well, because they're paying less for fuel, or maybe nothing for fuel if they fix up your house so well that it's passive, like mine here in the Rockies. Uh-huh. And indeed, Financial Times just reported that of the latest 160,000 passive buildings certified in Germany to a very rigorous standard, not needing heat and keeping you comfortable, 2/3 of those, they said, are retrofits, that is, fixing up old buildings. And then, of course, for new buildings, it's much easier. That cost is now the same as normal buildings or even a few percent less.
And I want to go back to, I've read a lot about your house that you're talking to us from today. And your house is, I think the walls are, what, 3 feet thick?
40 centimeters, so 16 inches thick. But
okay,
the 16. Floor is a high-grade foam.
But you need no heat, and you have no heating system whatsoever, and you're completely comfortable in the middle of the night at the elevation that you're at when it's 40 degrees below zero Fahrenheit.
Yeah, not that it gets okay. that cold anymore.
Okay. But we'll talk about that, too, because climate change is coming. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Amory Lovins is our guest today. He's one of the world's foremost energy thinkers, co-founder and chief scientist at Rocky Mountain Institute, He's also coming to Catawba College on April 17th to speak about energy and many of the topics that we'll be covering here this morning. We just talked about climate change, and it's inevitable. You just said it doesn't get that cold anymore in the Rockies. Climate scientists tell us repeatedly, they've been telling us repeatedly, that we are in real trouble if we don't get a handle on climate change in the next 10 years. I know that you agree, because you say the next 10 years are the preliminaries for our species' final exams. Talk about that. Well, you think that's funny. I don't.
I'd forgotten I wrote that, but yeah, I think it's true, and we better be studying real hard. Tough exams, because we've got a lot of things going on at once we need to fix. Now, in climate, models, which are now very sophisticated and well-validated, have been, as is often the way of science, quite conservative in understating how quickly climate change can move and how the weather and the climate can go haywire in nonlinear ways, kind of runaway ways that we didn't think of.
And we're seeing that now, are we not?
Yes, indeed. However, the good news is that the policy models based on those scientific simulations of climate were equally conservative in leaving out quite a few ways to avoid or mitigate climate change, often at a profit. Therefore, with these two offsetting effects, the race of our lives, as the investor Jeremy Grantham calls it, is very much in play, and neither despair nor complacency is warranted. We got a lot of work to do. Happily, most of what we need to do can be led by business for profit, and that is exactly what's happening. We did a major study, some would call it, I would call it maybe a synthesis, called Reinventing Fire. It's a business and design book that was published 2011 with 61 of us, with a lot of help from industry. And it showed how the U.S. could triple its energy efficiency and quintuple renewable supplies by 2050 at historically reasonable pace, and thereby end up with a 2.5-fold bigger economy than in 2010, but needing no oil, no coal, no nuclear energy, and a third less natural gas. We found that this would require no new inventions and no acts of Congress, but with smart state and local policies could be led by business for profit. So actually, just this afternoon, I'll be updating what's happened so far. The data have just come out. And as of 2017, I can tell you it's very much on track in the market. That is, the roadmap we laid out, the first 7 years of that 40-year journey, are developing as we proposed. I think because the private sector smells on the table the $5 trillion we can save by following this path rather than business as usual.
Then why do we seem to have so much recalcitrance among government of officials and leaders, and so much denial from politicians that climate change is not happening, or it's certainly not man-made, has nothing to do with fossil fuels? Obviously, a lot of those campaigns are funded by the fossil fuel industry, but if the fossil fuel industry knows about this and the money to be made, if they just get on board, why is there reluctance?
Well, some people in the fossil fuel industry, certainly not all of them, are worried about having to go into some other line of work, worried that their assets will lose value, and they'll get stuck with what are called stranded assets. For sure, that's going to happen.
So even though there's money to be made, there will be incredible disruption.
Yes, it is highly disruptive to the incumbents when the insurgents take over. 2017, the world bought 64% of its net additions of electric generating capacity from renewables, not counting big hydro. So I still sometimes hear people in the electricity business saying, oh, these solar and wind alternatives might amount to something in a few decades. And I'm tempted to say, dude, what part of they just took 2/3 of your market don't you get?
Mm-hmm.
And my CEO, who actually used to work for Shell a long time ago, example of flight of talent to other sectors, he gave a talk a while back to a bunch of gas industry executives laying out the competitive landscape they faced, which is pretty bleak. And a lot of the executives refused to believe market prices he was showing them were real numbers. They thought he was making it up, because they must have read for some other bunch of literature. I've had this experience a lot. I was talking to an extremely large nuclear utility abroad at one point, and their deputy head of strategy was saying, well, I know you have all these numbers on renewables and cogeneration competing with us, but I looked them up and I can't find those numbers. I think they're not real. It turned out he was looking up in a database for utility-owned assets, and practically all of them at that time were actually owned by third parties, by the insurgents. So, of course, he didn't find them there. You got to be careful what data you're looking
right.
at.
Amory Lovins is our guest. He is the co-founder and chief scientist at Rocky Mountain Institute and a world-renowned energy thinker. Just a moment ago, you talked about how the private sector seems to be way ahead of everybody else on this, and they're beginning to make inroads toward this new energy future. And there have been people in government who not only deny climate change, but who say, well, this is something the private sector needs to take care of. Let the market take care of it. Would I be right in saying that you think they're right because it's happening?
Broadly, although we don't have prices that tell the truth. For example, if we say that the price of putting carbon dioxide in the air, waste product of combustion, is zero, then we're really misleading ourselves, because it's not zero. We would be much better off not doing that, especially because the efficiency of renewables we ought to be doing anyway are actually cheaper than the current supplies in most of the country, and very soon in all of the country. So I do take economics seriously and markets seriously, not literally. And I once wrote in a book called Natural Capitalism, I think markets make a splendid servant a bad master and a worse religion. We need to use them for what they're good at, not try to substitute them for ethics or faith or politics.
So the market is beginning to move toward this because there is a lot of money to be made, and although it's disruptive, at some point, I guess the seesaw tips and you've got to go with the flow because you're going downhill if you don't. Would the government be helpful in greasing the skids in some way if they got in with incentive programs, or do you see that as even necessary at this point?
Well, I would actually love to desubsidize the entire energy sector and let everything compete fairly at honest prices, regardless of what technology it is, what kind, how big, where it is, who owns it. That's pretty much the opposite of the energy policy we have, which has been designed by and for lobbyists. but I'd just credit where it's due. I was in a webinar yesterday on profitably abating methane emissions, especially from the upstream end of the oil and gas industry, because you can profitably abate enough of the planned releases, the process emissions, to stabilize the global methane cycle. And that's a really big deal. That's as if on our runaway carbon train, we open this little door and there's this handbrake, which won't stop the train, but can slow it down a lot. That's very valuable to do by that precious time. Well, one of my colleagues on the panel noted that the EPA methane release standards were vigorously defended by, among others, Shell, BP, what used to be the Norwegian National Oil Company, now called Equinor, and a couple of other major oil companies, because they think it's the right thing to do. And by the way, it's a good strategy because it inconveniences their competitors more than themselves, because they're already following fairly good practices and continuing to improve. We see the same thing in the electricity business, where the more far-sighted, well-led companies are not only defending efficiency of renewables, they're aligning their own strategy around it. And here in Colorado, we have a company called Xcel Energy that has set probably the most ambitious private utility renewable targets in the country. And my own rural co-op here is doing the same thing. I believe they just said how they'd go from 20-odd to 70% renewable in the next few years. And they're going to save us members a lot of money that way.
You just mentioned the term, and I'm not sure many people have heard it, or maybe they even didn't hear you say it this time, the term natural capitalism. And you at Rocky Mountain Institute, you use a framework of natural capitalism, which refers to, if I'm correct about this, the planet's natural resources and ecological system. You say they have immense economic value and are literally priceless, but that current business practices fail to take account of the value of these assets. Can you be a little more specific and explain that in layman's terms and tell us why we seem to ignore that?
Well, our industrial capitalism is based on liquidating our assets without paying for them, and the assets I'm referring to are the natural systems that provide services we can't live without, like breathable air, drinkable water, edible food, health, what used to be a stable climate, and so on. And on the other hand, natural capitalism, which we proposed as a way of doing business as if nature and people were properly valued, is not about learning how much those natural systems are worth or signaling their value. Rather, behaving as if they were very valuable. And I think that's the right thing to do because it unleashes incredible potential for wealth creation and also fairness and decency in society. And it's a very much, again, a business-led, market-driven approach. But it doesn't only count money and goods, physical and financial capital, but also natural and human capital, the two most precious kinds, as capital. And what capitalism is about is productively using and reinvesting in capital. We just were defining capital too narrowly to be only about money and goods, and that's not a durable way to run an economy or a civilization.
But to shift toward that practice and to shift toward new energy thinking and essentially blow up what has been in place for 100 years and move to something new takes a lot of capital, takes a lot of money. And how do you convince companies that they need to do this and they need to spend this money when they could just as easily overly compensate their CEO or pay the money back to shareholders in the form of dividends and keep the stock value up? Spending money does the opposite in many cases. How do you convince them?
I would think of it as an old-fashioned word called investment. You actually need typically less capital than you were investing before, and you make better returns on it than you were before, which capitalists tend to be very interested in. Also, you get that at less risk than before, and investors really care about risk. So it's a better business deal. And for example, we could make better new buildings and fix up old buildings to triple or quadruple their energy efficiency, get them all done by 2050. And it turns out this has what's called an internal rate of return of 33%, which is extremely juicy.
Yes.
It means the savings are worth four times what they cost you. So, of course, any sensible investor will want to do that, and many are. Industry can double its efficiency with a 21% internal rate of return. The list goes on like that. And the to put it another way, the cost of getting our automobiles completely off oil used to be about $18 per saved barrel. It's now below 10, and in another 5 or 6 years, it'll be below zero. So that's why oil has become uncompetitive even at low prices before it becomes unavailable even at high prices. That means the oil companies actually have more oil in the ground that they can't sell for competitive reasons than oil that they can't burn for climate reasons. They're more at risk from market competition than from climate regulation. Some of them are starting to figure that out. And to get to your point about executive compensation, Shell has just put in a policy of tying executive compensation to how quickly they get the company into the new energy era and off carbon, off burning stuff.
So when we come back, we're going to talk about a lot of different things in a short amount of time, because you're all over the place with nuclear power and with, you just mentioned, the automobiles moving toward electric power and away from oil. And I want to go back to something you said that maybe people didn't hear or didn't believe, that there's $5 trillion of value waiting in the wings as a result of using no oil, no coal, no nuclear, one-third less natural gas, no new inventions, no act of Congress, all led by business for profit. This sounds too good to be true. Usually when things sound too good to be true, they are. But you're going to explain to us why they are not in this case. Emory Lovins is with us. He's the chief scientist and co-founder of Rocky Mountain Institute. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Lake Norman area towns Huntersville, Cornelius, and Davidson have experienced exponential growth in the last two decades. As a result, the area has faced challenges with development, transportation, and maintaining vibrant downtowns as leaders and planners work to keep up with rising numbers of residents. I'm Mike Collins. Join me for a special public conversation on growing pains in Lake Norman Thursday, April 18th at CPCC's Maracas campus in Huntersville at 7 p.m. For details and registration, go to WFAE.org. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Amory Lovins today. He is a climate scientist, one of the world's renowned energy thinkers. He's coming to Catawba College on April the 17th to speak at 6:30 at Keppel Auditorium. It's a free speech, but you have to register in advance, and we'll put information about that on our website. So we have this promise of $5 trillion of value with using no oil, no coal, no nuclear, a third less natural gas, no inventions, no act of Congress. And furthermore, you think that to solve the problems that we face with energy, you don't need to shrink them, you need to enlarge them. You integrated the four sectors that consume the most energy: transportation, buildings, industry, and electricity. And you say that it is easier to solve our energy challenges by putting all this together rather than separately. That seems to require some explaining. Please do.
Well, for example, it's easier to solve the electricity and car problems together than separately. And several reasons for that. We're at the early stage of a rapid and momentous shift from gasoline cars to electric cars, partly because they're just better. Anybody who drives a modern electric car will experience that. And they're also a better deal. And in another few years, 2023 or 2024 probably, they won't cost more to buy. than a gasoline car. But one side effect of that is that batteries become very much cheaper, and batteries are one of the 10 ways to balance the grid to accommodate varying solar and wind power very reliably. Batteries are heading, especially with some new kinds, for cheap enough that it would cost you hardly any extra to make your rooftop solar 24/7, at which point the grid itself could even become an optional convenience for ordinary users.
So you're saying that the development of electric cars, as they get better and cheaper, is going to push the technology in batteries, which then can be applied to other things and make us energy independent of the grid. Is that what you're saying?
Offers that option, certainly, and that is what's happening. Lithium batteries got 35% cheaper in the past year. The year before that, they got 37% cheaper, and so on. In addition, these electric cars are massive batteries on wheels, and they're parked quite a lot of the time, which means that they, in turn, can help balance the grid and provide many other valuable stability and other services to the grid, enough that in some parts of Europe, people can earn back half the sticker price of the car by selling those services to the grid.
If they're feeding the grid the battery, the power that's stored in the battery of their car, when they unplug it from the grid to use it, is there anything left in the battery to power the car?
Yes, of course. Whole system is smart enough to leave you plenty of power to get where you're next headed. In Amsterdam today, if you come to the soccer game at the big stadium with your electric car fully charged up and you plug it in, all those plugged-in cars actually run the stadium and they let you in for free. Hmm. But they also leave you plenty of juice to get home with.
Wow. You helped design and won awards for something I'd never heard of. It's called Hypercar. You developed what you describe as a competitively manufacturable virtual design for a 114 mile per gallon fuel cell mid-sized SUV, and you've designed other more efficient automobiles as well. And the Rocky Mountain Institute has a goal of 100% vehicle electrification by 2030. Is that pie in the sky, or is that doable?
It's doable. We've published a lot often with industry about how to do it. And the automakers around the world are racing as fast as they can to reinvent themselves as electric car companies. I understand General Motors, for example, has already designed its last gasoline engine. It will still make gasoline cars for a while, but the market is shifting very, very rapidly. Now, a hypercar starts off being very light, which can still be very safe because modern materials like carbon fiber composites we use in aerospace and in sporting goods, that's an extremely strong but light material. And there are now techniques for making cars out of it cost effectively. Why does this matter? Well, because the majority of the energy it takes to move your car is caused by its weight, and every unit of energy you save at the wheels by taking out weight or drag also saves about 5 units of fuel you don't need to waste getting the energy to the wheels through the engine and driveline, and therefore compounds to save like 5 or 6 units of fuel at the tank. So lightweighting is the most important way to save energy in a car.
So is your hypercar, you use 114 miles per gallon as a metric. Is your hypercar gasoline powered or is it electric powered?
Oh, that particular one was a hydrogen fuel cell design. If you ran it on a gasoline hybrid like a Prius engine but only 1 liter, then it would be 67 miles a gallon for a midsize SUV. However, I actually drive a hypercar. It happens to be a German car, but it came on the market in 2013. And the whole passenger cell is made of carbon fiber. Interesting thing, it takes 2/3 less capital and water to make it than a normal steel car, half the normal energy time and space to make it, That one's 124 miles per gallon equivalent. It's an electric car. And the carbon fiber, which people used to think was terribly expensive, is actually paid for by needing fewer batteries because you're hauling around less weight. So it completely offsets the weight of the batteries and the cost of the carbon fiber is paid for. The ultralighting is free because of the saved batteries and the simpler manufacturing. This is stuff we'd been claiming since the 90s, and now this German automaker, very well-known one, has proven it.
It's got three letters in its name.
Yeah, with that car. The dean of auto production and costing in Detroit, a fellow named Sandy Monroe, says it's the most advanced vehicle on the planet.
More so than the Tesla?
Well, and the most remarkable car since the Model T. Well, I would say the Tesla, and I also drive a Model 3 Tesla, is the other car on the market with real engineering genius. I know the people that designed both of those, and they are really extraordinary.
The other car you're talking about is the BMW i3.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think anybody that drives either of these is going to be quite impressed. And the BMW i3 apparently made money from the first unit off the assembly line. I don't think you can say that for other electric cars.
Integration
of light and slippery plus electric gives you a lot more than the sum of parts.
So if we're moving toward this electric car reality in the next 10 or 15 years, that means we're going to be relying more and more on electricity and on the grid, and that means the power plants in some distant place have to bring that power to your battery in your car. And you used to be a proponent of nuclear until some switch in your brain switched over, and now you don't believe in nuclear. You say nuclear is not the answer, that it would make global warming worse, and that there is no business advantage to nuclear power. Why?
It costs too much. End of story. It costs so much that there isn't a business case for building more reactors anywhere in the world. And upwards of half of those now operating are financially in distress because it costs more just to operate them, including continuing to fix them, than it would cost to buy new wind and solar power or efficiency.
Yeah, you say that new nuclear plant, you say a new nuclear plant can generate electricity at a cost of 12 cents an hour. Renewable sources can do it for 3 cents a kilowatt hour. That's an amazing difference.
Yeah, and those are actually a bit old numbers because, for example, in the unsubsidized Mexican market just across the border from Texas, five quarters ago, the wind power was selling for 1.7 cents a kilowatt hour, solar power for 1.9. Now those prices are even lower. That's pretty typical. We've gone through 3 cents and now through 2 cents, heading for what on renewables? And efficiency is typically around 2 cents a kilowatt hour in the average utility program, but you can offer much cheaper than that, which is why it's kind of interesting that I believe in North Carolina, the gas companies get rewarded for cutting your bill, not for selling you more gas. But I don't think we quite do it that way yet for electricity. And South Carolina doesn't have any of the modern utility reforms yet, as of at least last summer.
But people will say, they'll cite these numbers that you just gave if they buy into this, and they'll say, but, you know, the wind doesn't always blow and the sun doesn't always shine, so we got to have these coal-fired plants, we got to have nuclear, we got to have other forms of electric power generation. You call that the baseload myth. Why is that not true?
Well, we used to be very well-served built the modern economy by what a lot of people call baseload plants, which would run not all the time, because sometimes they break, but as much of the time as possible, steadily. However, the reason they did that was that they were the cheapest plants to operate. And that's the economic criterion that's always governed the utility business. Once you built the plant, whatever you paid for it, that's a sunk cost. You can't unspend it. You can only make decisions about the future, not the past. And therefore, you operate or dispatch plants according to what's cheapest to run. The cheapest to run plants are supposed to get run the most. The costliest to run plants are supposed to run the least. Well, nowadays, renewables, which have no fuel, are the cheapest plants to run. So you run them whenever they're available, and then you ramp any fueled plants up and down to follow and to integrate with the variations also of load. But now we can also vary load a lot in smart ways the customers don't even notice. And when you put all the moving parts together, you can get equally reliable power without any steam raising, any of the old fueled power plants. We actually showed this for Texas, which is a tough case because it has no big hydro dams, and it's not even connected to the rest of the country. It has its own grid and a tough climate. So if you use electricity modestly more efficiently, with a 10% real return on investment, says the National Academy, and you then run at 86% on solar and wind and 14% on other renewables that you can have whenever you want, because those aren't the only two kinds, then you get 100% renewable power every hour of the year. And to balance the grid, you only need to have all electric cars intelligently connected to the grid to charge and discharge, and ice storage air conditioning. So your air conditioner makes ice at night, and the melting ice keeps you cool in the daytime. That's all straightforward and on the market. Well, if you do that, you end up all renewable with no bulk storage, and the price is right. It actually would be very economically attractive even at today's prices, let alone.
But what's the cost of getting? What's the cost of getting there? What's the cost of? This is a lot of new infrastructure and new equipment, isn't it?
Yes, but we are continuously rebuilding the grid anyway, and the total cost of building and running solar and wind is now less than just the operating cost of even, say, gas-fired power plants. Mm-hmm. Even in Texas, some of them are going broke for exactly that reason. Whatever you can do with a gas plant, you can now do cheaper without it.
So we have about a minute and a half left, and you say that this country's energy mix will continue to go steadily and strongly away from coal, despite the president's efforts. Nuclear will continue to decline, and renewables will come in to take up the slack. So what's the timetable for that in your mind?
A lot quicker than the incumbents are prepared to cope with or often even understand. This is a formidable challenge to leadership in the energy industries. As Jack Welch said, if the rate of change on the outside is greater than the rate of change on the inside, the end is near. And I think a lot of them have that queasy feeling that, you know, the ground's shifting under their feet. They don't quite know what to do about it.
Yeah, Jack Welch is the former chairman and CEO of General Electric, who's a legend in his own time. But you say that we've lived in a world largely created by the titans of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, who brought us internal combustion vehicles and incandescent electric light bulbs, both energy inefficient, and now we are on the cusp of change. We have 21st century technology and speed colliding head-on with 20th century and 19th century institutions, rules, and cultures, and the first two of these great industries are coming together to eat the third.
We'll leave it at that.
Amory Lovins, co-founder, chief scientist at Rocky Mountain Institute, thank you so much for the hour. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.